everyone. Look, I was terribly interested by the biggest fail in this survey, which is the concept of shareholder return and whether they are a good source of business to focus on. And I always think, given the participation of Australians in super and the extent of that, it's incredible that the disconnect is still so wide. So I'm genuinely curious what the panel might think about that and, you know, why we just can't unify these people who sometimes actually have quite a strong mutual interest, but clearly we're not there. We're not even close.
I'll just give you two data points, if you like, that I think are interesting context. So we did ask people to identify whether they were shareholders, and only about 30% of survey respondents did identify as shareholders. So it's still that vexed question of around, yes, having superannuation, because obviously the coverage would be greater than that for the survey, but not seeing yourself as a shareholder. So that still exists. Of that group who did identify as shareholders, they were more inclined to prioritise returns to shareholders, and they did prioritise to a greater extent the shareholders as stakeholders, although still not to the extent that you would expect. I think they're still rating their preferences, if you like, as customers, employees, and, you know, mothers and fathers, for want of a better description, ahead of being a shareholder, is my sense of the data point.
Now, I suspect that's a big part of it. Does it matter, do you think?
Well, I'm going to...
Yeah, I mean, I think it goes to the level of trust, doesn't it? Because they don't recognise themselves as invested in the businesses that they're expecting this from, whereas they very much are. Maybe not directly, but certainly, you know, more broadly. And one thing that I thought was interesting when I stepped back from the research and thinking about, you know, the question that we're going to talk about is whether business leaders should speak out on ESG issues, is that the expectations of the broader community aren't that inconsistent with the expectations of the big super funds in terms of managing that longer term risk. And so there is some alignment there, but, you know, I think the point is that that superannuation that is in big funds, the community sees themselves a step away from that.
Natasha, you work with employees all the time. What are they thinking about this?
So it's a perennial problem for us, because shareholder at the board level, at the senior executive level, it's always about returning shareholder value. But when you're coming to work every day, working long days and putting everything in, the shareholder is somebody that's faceless. And it's kind of, at times, I think for employees, can seem a little unfair that you're doing all of this work to give something back to a shareholder who is a faceless, nameless entity that exists outside them. So I think for people, I think as a business, the shareholder is essential in a lot of ways. I think advertising it to employees is not always the best approach.
So is finding a way for employees to participate in the upside of the business a practical thing companies can do?
In theory, very complex.
I do think share schemes and employee share schemes, you know, providing that skin in the game, I think it does create a clearer link for them. But when I've been, you know, talking to people about the survey, I think one of the things I've tried to emphasise, and in some ways, you know, when you force people to say what's the most important, you kind of force perhaps a more extreme response, right? So I will say that, and we were trying to get people to say, you know, to actually do that, right? But in reality, it is more nuanced than that. And, you know, the example that I've used is, big resources companies, right? They're at the forefront of managing environmental issues. They're at the forefront of responding to investor concerns around the environment, because people understand their impact on the environment. It's very visible, it's very demonstrable. Equally, if you're a BHP, you know, you've been working in remote communities. You've been an anchor institution in remote communities for decades.
Big employer too. Mm.
Yeah, and you've been working with local landowners, Aboriginal communities, providing jobs for them, investing in those communities as an anchor member of that community for decades. So to then sort of slice and dice it and then have a conversation that is so heavily focused on shareholder value, I think actually doesn't resonate with a lot of employees or other people who are seeing that business's operations day to day. And so for me, I think one of the questions is, my reading from this and my conversations with people across all sectors and in the community is not that people think that shareholders don't deserve an appropriate return, and an appropriate return that reflects risk and the risks and their long-term investment and all the rest of it. But I think what they're saying is that the absolute prioritisation of that and the communication of that as being above all else is maybe something that's being questioned.
And I think the other observation on that suggestion of employee participation, you know, inequity in their own companies is a very small solution to a much bigger issue, because when we're talking about this disconnect between community expectation around shareholder return, so it's the broad community in relation to shareholder return from broad business broadly, where we're really only talking about my participation in my own employee's business. And so I don't think it's the fix.
Yeah. Great. Okay. Well, I really want to hear what the panel has to say about the whole concept of trust. Trust is one of the themes of our business summit, and it's definitely a very difficult thing for some people to get their heads around. So in your view, is the license to operate and the social good the same thing, or are they things that can be broken apart and compartmentalised?
It's a hard one. It is a really hard one, and I think it's quite a complex question, because it's about looking at community expectations of business, and then looking at business's response to those expectations, and when it comes to trust, as to how those come together. That's really not about what the expectations are on either side. It's about the relationship, and so when we think about trust, it's got to be built on something that is genuine and authentic. Mm. That's exactly what I had been thinking about, and Melinda was talking about that. But when we're looking at business speaking on particular issues or taking a stand and looking at the community expectations of that, it's about how authentic business is, so organisations as a whole and individuals who are leading those organisations, how authentic they are in talking about that and how genuine they are. And that then becomes very complex, because it goes to the cynicism that was borne out in the report.
The virtue signalling.
Correct. Yeah. So it's about, and I think that's really difficult, because as an individual or as a business, to speak about an issue, you can only speak about an issue that either impacts you or that you care about. And so you are going to have a degree of self-interest in what you're talking about, and you won't be genuine or authentic if you're just picking an issue that's outside your realm of influence and experience and talking about it. I think that's when you're virtue signalling.
I think one of the other challenges too,
yeah,
is... I think more and more companies are clearly understanding that they need to understand and reflect community expectations and being seen to be responding to them. And I think, so you said you can speak to an issue that you care about or impacts you. I think the challenge comes when people think you're speaking about something because you think it matters to them, and so you're going to speak to it, but you're not.
Yeah,
explaining why it's important to you, or you're not explaining why it's important to your company. The social license, social good issue, I mean, it's lots of different language. I can give you just a couple of other data points, if you like, from the survey. So one of the other really strong messages was, so we asked people Do you think that companies should essentially only obey the law? Right, should
minimum.
Yep. Just as long as you obey the law and rules and regulations, tickety-boo, that's good enough for me. And yeah, 10%, 12% of people said yes. So that was, you know, that's pretty much the minority. And then what you had was about, let's call that 10%. Then you had roughly 45% who said, actually what we think business should do is do everything it can to impact, to improve its social and environmental community performance. And then roughly 45% actually wanted that plus influencing the whole nations. So I think that's kind of, it's almost like split about social license in a way, is that middle group, and the sort of broader purpose, national interest is the other group. And so, you know, so I think that's maybe a bit of data there. And the only other point I'd make is that in conversations I've been having with different companies, that there's already starting to be a shift around a license implies that you've been given permission. Mm-hmm. You've got your driver's license, so you've got permission to drive. And actually more companies are now thinking about, well, that in itself is almost a minimum. How do I create value? Like, what's my social value proposition, so that people can see that I'm contributing, we as a company are contributing a value. So, it's another step from that.
I was thinking about the trust. So, again, in the people space, trust is essential. If we're going to, it's something we talk a lot about with employees, we look at lots of different ways of doing it. And I love the Covey notion of character and competence. And so when I think about that, taking it from the individual level up to the organisational level, and it ties into the types of things that we talk about, is you have to, if you're talking about stuff you don't know anything about, then it's also going to devalue the impact that you have, and it's going to sound more disingenuous when you jump on a topic that it's not within that area of competence or expertise. And so for me, when I think about the organisations that have failed in the trust space, it's usually a failure of systems, and it's a failure of key individuals, and it's a failure of people to step in and manage that, walking past behaviours that lead to bad outcomes. But for it's that relationship then between what is the character of the organisation you want to have, what are the behaviours that you won't walk past, what are the courageous conversations that you have within the organisation that then limit the damage that can be done when those things happen. And certainly for us, we do, in terms of the social, we have a new, what we call social impact practice, which is very much in the technology space, obviously, as a technology company, but it's how do we really contribute to building technology skills? How do we contribute to building that technology pathway across the whole industry? And it is good for us, because the more people who are interested in technology and STEM, I have five children, but four girls, and we are the STEM problem, because I have one out of the four who's interested in robotics and coding. The other three want to run cafes and write books. So it's how do we engage and make it exciting? How do we make it so that they're protected, so when they enter the workforce, you know, several years from now, they're insulated, but how then that's good for us as an organisation as well. And I think it's hard for organisations, because we are a business, we do have shareholders, we do have responsibilities, and at the same time, there are things that we're keen to do within our area of expertise. So for me, that trust things comes, it goes back to that what's good for the individual is good for the organisation, and the character of an organisation in terms of how it represents itself, and the competence it has in terms of the work that it does, and then the way that it displays that outside.
Well, Natasha, you make a good point, because if someone's speaking outside of an area of their competency, you've got the authenticity issue, which it turns out people are highly sensitive to, and the optics are terrible. I mean, if we're talking about that kind of scenario, should a business just not say anything?
I don't think there's a one answer to that.
Yeah.
I think it comes back to what the issue is. I like the idea of making our people courageous. So, and enabling our people to come to work brave enough to speak internally and externally about the issues that are important to them. And in that way, and doing it the right way, creates the conversation internally, and also then represents the organisation more outside. not going to be making any kind of policy about what we should be talking about externally.
But there must be things the organisation can't agree on.
Yeah, but I think that's true of the community at large. Yeah. And I think the biggest risk is when we stop having differences of opinion and we stop having the conversations. I think that's a much bigger risk than whether or not we come out with a particular point of view on an issue that's topical at a particular point in time.
Yeah. But can I just say too, like, I think, you know, there's plenty of issues that are going to get done in a business, plenty of things that are going to get done in a business that not everyone agrees with. Right, there's going to be an approach to how you roll out rosters. There's going to be an approach to how you do training. There's going to be an approach to we're going to invest in this rather than this. And somewhere in the organisation, someone's going to go, well, I wouldn't invest in that. I would have done this. Or I wouldn't have sold that business. I would have done this. Or, you know, what colours are you going to paint the office walls? I mean, I think it's kind of interesting that there's a whole range of issues. Now, it won't be as visible clearly and someone's got to make a decision. But I do find it fascinating that that this becomes so much more polarising at a certain level.
Yes.
Oh, sorry. Oh, I was only going to say that not taking any action at all, whether it's internally or as leaders, you know, in the community and in the country, just leads to paralysis. Mm. So not taking action because you are nervous that you're going to upset somebody, as, you know, Melinda was talking about, there's always difficult conversations to be had. I think what is important to make sure, because this is all about trust and how you build trust with your stakeholders, whether internal stakeholders and external, trust can be eroded far more quickly than it is created and built if you get it wrong. So I think the answer isn't to do nothing, but the answer is to be very conscious and careful about what you're doing and planning. And I see that in a lot of the business leaders and companies that we do see speaking out and taking a stand on issues, whether that's environmental issues, social issues or policy issues, you can see that it's well thought out, it's well planned. I know that for a number of our clients there's been, you know, appropriate consultation with various stakeholders before they actually do that, even though it comes across as very sometimes
impulsive,
spontaneous, authentic, you know, and very successful in many cases.
We've got a lot of consensus from the audience on this question, and it's about the differences amongst respondents based on the older, younger, and male and female audience. I was really interested, one of the key points in the survey was about specifically the views of millennials. And I'm genuinely interested what the panel has to think about whether their views are informed by their own life experience and the new brave world that they're in, or the experience of their parents, which is a previous generation. And perhaps the 1976 survey would be instructive in that.
I don't know, I've got kids. They're not informed by my
views. I was about to say exactly the same thing. The teenagers in my house are not informed by me.
I have little and I have a millennial. So I would say there are some, I would say that sitting around the dinner table, there are some times where my husband and I are challenged by the perspective that comes at us.
Only sometimes.
but then I think... And we have a huge grad program. So we've had about 80 grads, 80 or 90 grads the last couple of years. We've got 200 coming in next year. And so it's a huge change to the way that our organisation... our origins are dinosaur tech companies. So we're going from dinosaur tech companies to digital transformation with hundreds of millennials. And it's in some ways... The technology brings everyone together because there's a real passion for it in the space that we're in. But the perspectives on things around opportunities, recognition, conversation, those kinds of things are quite different. So it's finding the balance and educating our managers as well on how to deal with it, but also educating our millennials as well. So we do a lot of work with them. We do 3 days with them around, not around their work, but really around How do you work with people? How does your brain work? How do you deal with change? Because the speed at which the organisation changes is hard for them. I mean, we had one group that started, and a month later we became DXC. So they started with one company, with, you know, 5,000 people, and then a month later we had 10,000 people, and they had to adapt. They have to, we go through restructures and moves, so they have to move. One day they're working with team A, the next time they're working with team B.
But work is hard, right?
Yeah, and that's the message we give them. Work is hard, right, and that you need to deal with those challenges.
I think one of the differences, if I reflect on the way my kids are seeming to, and the eldest is close to millennial, but the way they're forming their views compared to, you know, what I was, the way I was when I was their age, you know, you had to go and reach out to people who had the information, right? And so that was informed by conversations with my parents, or like you could just go and pick up your phone and go and look for ideas on things. And so now my kids are, you know, forming their own views on a whole range of things. And I'll give you, you know, one slightly personal example. My eldest daughter, a couple of years ago when she was still at high school, was writing an essay on the global financial crisis. So I'm an economist. I actually worked at the International Monetary Fund during the Asian financial crisis. I've got a master's in economics. I worked in financial markets. She didn't even, she never once asked me. Like, not even nothing. And I went, oh, all right then.
Does she blame you for it?
Maybe, maybe. And she got an A for it, which really infuriated me. But I think it's just, it is a good sort of example. Like, the, you know, I would have been talking, you know, if I was writing that essay, I would have been saying to my parents at the very least, where can I get information on this? What do you know? They're business people. You know, and nowadays, no.
And that must be one of the factors that play, not the defining factor, but a factor that goes to why there might be such different views, is that, you know, this generation access information themselves. I learn things, you know, that I'm not aware of around social issues from my own children, from our young lawyers,
from
you know,
your boss.
Here. Yep, absolutely. But I just was thinking, you know, we should see it as a real opportunity in terms of the divergence of views, because we've got that diversity within our organisations, and we can harness that and bring it together. And I'm sure, you know, you do a lot of work around that.
I think, sorry, I was just going to say that I think the two thing I do notice with the children, and even with my millennial and in the workplace, is the information's accessible, the critical thinking isn't as deep as it used to be. When you had to go to encyclopedia, you know, go to the library, find the encyclopedia, have a look, you had to kind of synthesise information a lot more. So I find that a lot of the times the conversations we're having at work and at home are around, we get the headline and then it's a couple of critical questions to get them to see the nuances so that you see the information, and then it's, oh, this is a stupid decision that the business has made. Well, yes, but did you realise that these are the 10 things that feed into that? So there's there's a mutual education process that's going on as well.
When you can find information to suit any bias you might have, yes, then what is the point of that information? I mean, are we sort of arriving at a point, and this is sort of to get to the trust thing again, does the voice of business count more than the voice of a media personality, a friend, Greta, an industry super fund? Everyone has a voice now.
I mean, the way I've been looking at this, I mean, again, I'll try to in sprinkle in a bit of information from the survey. We did ask some questions around, there's some questions in there about the sort of impacts for business for doing the wrong thing, of unethical behaviour. And interestingly, actually, there was a bit of cynicism there around not just government response, but whether there were long-term repercussions for business doing the wrong thing. So there was definitely a sense that in the short term there would be adverse publicity and they might lose some customers. But, you know, realistically, my sort of take on it was actually people weren't sort of saying there was going to be this big long-term impact. And there was some questions around, does fake news make it harder to assess business performance and their behaviour, and that was definitely something that people were sort of flagging is an issue. But I think the irony is that this survey tells you that people, I think, have broad expectations and see an important role for business across the spectrum. That's my take on this headline. But they are still cynical. And the challenge is, and they are worried about fake news, but equally, you've got more opportunity than ever if you're a business to communicate directly to your important stakeholders what you've heard from them, how you're responding, and where the proof points are. I mean, there's more opportunity for transparency now than ever before. And so I think that's the conundrum. Now, yes, people are going to search for the information that confirms or affirms their perspectives more often than not, but equally, it is probably easier than it's ever been to communicate directly to people who you feel would be interested in or concerned about a particular issue and your performance. And there is an increasing focus on ensuring that that is available to be independently scrutinised and assessed.
There's a really interesting question from the floor which mentions Atlassian, which is a company that's very socially aware, founded by two people who are now AFR rich listers and are very articulate in their views, but they extend well beyond the realm of technology. So have we arrived at a point where if you're from the tech community, it's acceptable for you to speak out on things beyond your competency or beyond the relevance of your stakeholders? And if you're from the energy sector, for example, which is a huge part of our economy, are you at a natural disadvantage?
Because of perceptions.
Because maybe the optics aren't as soft, because you're in fossil fuels, for example.
So your point is that it's easier for Mike Cannon Brooks because he comes from a sexy industry that doesn't... Yeah.
And you can have a very large share of voice.
I don't think it's as simple as that in terms of, you know, which industry. Because it was interesting, the AFR power list came out this morning, and if you look at the top 10 most powerful people in Australian business, a number of those CEOs are CEOs who do stand up and speak out on issues beyond what is relevant to their own businesses. And I think it's also interesting that in the top 10 we've also got... investors in our companies for whom ESG, management of ESG risk and ESG issues is really important. So, just going back to that, I don't think it's about that it's easy for Atlassian to take that stand. I think, because you see Atlassian, Qantas, BHP, Mervac, all of these companies will stand up and we'll talk about issues beyond their immediate business and many others. Mm. So I mean,
it's a complex question, to be honest. Yeah. So my personal view is that people listen to the views of successful people because they've been successful. There's a business leader who's been wildly successful. And of course, and if he's explaining with enthusiasm and passion and authenticity why something matters to him, people will listen to that. But they're not going to listen to it because he's making decisions necessarily in his day-to-day business. So I think there's people hear these things in different ways. It's not the right way to put it, but you're right to speak on something. There are different sources of that, right? And then... to just take it on another different tangent and to go back a few years in my experiences of life, when I worked at the Business Council of Australia, there was a period of time where the business leaders had not been heavily involved around issues of reconciliation and Indigenous engagement. And that was starting to bother an increasing number of them because the economy was going really well. And quite frankly, the anecdote was they would go overseas and people would ask them about it. What the heck are you guys doing? And so there was a group that were very keen for the BCA to think about what it could do in this space. Now, there is a direct kind of line of sight to this, if you like, around employment and education and whatever. But to get to my point, when Richard Goyder stood up as the CEO of Wesfarmers and spoke about this, he was an unusual suspect. He was a new voice in the space. And it moved the dial because he spoke from the heart and he explained why he was interested in it. So I just think there are lots of different aspects to this, and what they've done has been directly related to their business. It's been clearly beneficial to the business, and it's been explained all the way through how, why, and different parts of the Wesfarmers business has come at it in different ways. So, and then the final point I'd make is anyone in this room who's ever expressed an opinion in the media in Australia knows that you don't do that without expecting to be challenged, criticised, and had the microscope put over you. So, and with all due respect to your paper, I think Mike Cannon-Brooks has come in for a bit of a bashing in Rear Window today, not least because of his, you know, attitudes on climate. So I don't think anyone does this not expecting to be challenged, criticised, critiqued, and otherwise scrutinised.
Melinda, do you think the community is sick of hearing from the same voices and there's not enough diversity of views out there?
I think it's a challenge everywhere. I can tell you it's a challenge when you sit at the board as an only female and talk about diversity all the time. Eventually people stop listening to you. So having different voices and encouraging other people to speak out is the biggest challenge in driving change.
Do you think it has to necessarily come from a CEO or a chairman? I mean, are there people within the organisation that don't have a profile that would actually make really authoritative case studies or advocates?
Oh, I think then you're straying into areas of real challenge around, I mean, whether if they go and do it in their own voice, but rightly so, companies have to have pretty clear guidelines. I mean, we've got guidelines at CEDA about who's a spokesperson for CEDA. You need to be on the page. And, you know, because, I mean, in some ways it risks eroding the credibility and authenticity of your voice if you're not really clear about exactly what it is you're doing and why.
I agree with that, but I do think there's something in increasing the voices that we hear, which organisations can be involved in to make sure that it's not the same... the same person, the same spokesperson all the time.
Yeah.
And so I think in a planned way and in an authentic way, you can broaden, you know, the representation of your organisation and company. Yeah.
I mean, Natasha, you must have employees who go on social media and have strong opinions. Do you keep an eye on that?
Not as much as I'd like to. I think it's... I was listening... As I was listening, I was reflecting, actually, we have an executive... leadership development program and it's all around creating a white paper around a business problem. And coming back to getting more voices is sometimes the things that are that people in the business are really passionate about aren't visible to our leaders. It's not on their radar for whatever reason. They might know it exists, but it's not really critical. And one of the people did something around the Indigenous building around an Indigenous procurement piece in our contracts and a reconciliation action plan, and the passion with which our CEO comes, we have a day at the end of the year and the top 15 present their ideas, and he was one of the 15. And the passion that he had was contagious. Mm. So I think that there's definitely one of the ways to create more voices is to tap into the passions of people and get them to share them, and to create an environment where they're able to demonstrate the courage to share that passion in a way that's appropriate. But you're right, we can't have them running around the streets and do it because part of the other piece is that if the authenticity also comes from it being consistent in your brand, consistent in your presentations, so that at things like this or wherever a spokesperson of the company is, they're speaking with a similar tone and similar perspective. And that means that gives you the authenticity and the credibility when you do come out with those statements, and it can then come... It creates more of your business story.
Mm.
But the cost of not speaking out is almost nothing if you're on a board. So how are we... If we want to hear this greater share of voice from a greater number of people, genuine interest, how do we incentivise this to happen when there's almost no penalties for not doing so?
For me, the penalties are coming increasingly from commercial elements.
Mm.
So if you don't have an Aboriginal Reconciliation Action Plan, that's going to cost you. And if you don't have a diversity and inclusion plan and you're not bringing more women into your executive positions and you're not doing these things, ultimately, it's going to cost you. So it's much better to... So there is a cost in not doing it. It's just it's not a fine. But ultimately, if these issues that are in the community, if they're not starting to become part of your narrative as a business, then there are, not with everybody, some people won't care, but there are increasingly organisations that do care, and we're a largely B2B kind of structure. So that's for true. Us, if we don't care, we will it'll cost us.
Yeah, I think the other, just to put a finer point on it, I mean, you know, the thing I hear from almost every business member is that their ability to attract talent now depends on a far broader range of, you know, factors and values than ever before. And I look around the room and just watch everyone nod when I say, how many people have interviewed someone recently and felt like they were being interviewed? Yes. and, you know, you can't... I think there is an expectation. For that group of people, hearing something in an interview that's not... doesn't resonate with what you know about the company or what you're hearing from other people or what you find on their website, I think is going to raise alarm bells. And equally, having been involved, you know, for the better part of 3 years in twice-yearly ESG conversations as a chair of a remuneration committee, you know, you get asked these questions by investors now.
Yeah.
And again, you know, sitting there in... a one-hour meeting with someone and putting your hand on your heart and saying you're doing all these things and not having any, you know, public proof points actually doesn't resonate. So there are, you know, multiple ways in which the challenge is being put. But I think that's about, you know, ESG broadly defined, and then there is this next question around, you know, call it advocacy, whatever you want, for a broader range of issues, which for some reason is now... kind of just been badged activism.
Right. But activism can mean so many different things. Do you think that the investment community could do a better job being the watchdog of the broader community in their interaction with boards and management?
I mean, I think my feedback from industry super funds, for instance, is that you know, they are reflecting the questions and issues that are being put to them. And I think that's appropriate.
Yeah, and I think that is happening, that, you know, when we, that whole conversation, we started talking about community expectation, we were talking about employees, and it's also about investors and their expectations of business.
So investors are often told by difficult management, rarely, but sometimes, that they can sell the shares if they're not happy. and that'll probably keep happening, because why not? But... do investors need more than the strikes, for example, to exercise their interests?
Well, of course, the strikes were not brought in for this issue,
weren't.
Which is I think they exercise, you know, they exercise their influence in many different ways. I think a lot of the directors in this room would say that they don't need any more power or tools to express their views. That's a complex question, I think.
Yeah, I think that we could look to Angus over here, but I think, you know, most... You look at the number of resolutions that are now being put.
Mm.
Mm-hmm.
You look at the way many companies are engaging with... different groups around key issues. You know, I think that's changed. I think people, you know, I think boards are engaging. I think they, on the whole, they understand that that's expected of them now, and vice versa, I have to say. So groups that go to put motions before an AGM that haven't actually had a conversation with the company about their performance, or, you know, I think that's also shifting as well, that, you know, that's not seen as being appropriate. And, you know, you do have to balance, make sure you've got, you know, the interests of all shareholders properly reflected in how those voices are heard. And, for what it's worth, my sense is, having sat on a board that was front and centre on these kinds of issues, is that they are being responded to.
So we have a big issue in the community at the moment, in that the banks... have to respond to a Reserve Bank rate cut, and the Federal Treasurer has made his view known, and banks have to pick a side because not everyone could be happy with the outcome. It will come down to depositors investors, borrowers, and sometimes the same person could be all three, conceivably. So what kind of conversation goes on when they're trying to meet the standards of the community and a massive investor base, and also representing a massive part of the economy?
So I was at the community dinner with the RBA board last night. This is a very topical question. And, you know, the short answer is that they're really complex conversations. Mm-hmm. And I think the two things I would say that were being balanced, well, so obviously borrowers versus savers, front and centre, but I think sitting in the backdrop is also a question around the extent to which these cuts are actually significantly impacting activity, which I think is, you know, is also something that people are talking about and a factor. And for what it's worth, without naming names, you know, asking this of a senior bank official, you know, not RBA official, a commercial bank, that they were, when I asked them directly, had they seen signs through their own credit card data or whatever, that lower interest rates was driving increased consumption to any meaningful way, and their response was no.
Was there anything in the survey that was sort of in that orbit?
No.
But perhaps as, you know, companies reinvent themselves to be more digital rather than dinosaur, you can't really see a scenario where interest rates play into that, I can't imagine.
Well, I think, I mean, you know, the flip side of this, there's the decisions they're making are around borrowers, savers, the cost of borrowing for them as well. There's a lot of factors at play, and the general observation is that these are decisions that are being weighed very carefully, with the full weight of understanding of expectation of all key stakeholders, if I can put it that way.
I think that's a really, like, not, I'm clearly not qualified to answer this question, but it was more around, though, that the complexity of decisions that happen in an organisation, that there are so, and often the opportunity to share the message is in a snapshot, and it's that's where the trust comes back to it, because the higher the trust, the more believable the snapshot is going to be, and when that trust isn't high, that's when we're presented with more challenges. So things that are seemingly simple decisions have multiple factors, as certainly with a 10,000 person company, let alone 120,000 people. So it's hard. We always wanted to distill it down to something that's simple and easy to explain, but often the complexity is where the richness is, but it's hard to convey that, and the lower the trust, the harder it is to break through with that message.
So the governor of the Reserve Bank also has a similar challenge, as he explained last night. He explained that he was getting feedback on the way to the event, with people driving down Nicholson Street shouting out that he was doing a crap job. Presumably a saver.
Presumably. So I might take the rest of the questions from the audience. There's some very punchy ones. So we'll try and keep the answers tight for you and lift the intensity as we hit the end. So trust, there's no escaping it. Is part of the general community's view informed by the fact that they believe business leaders are taking more of the pie for themselves, which I think is a pay question? Belinda, you must have something.
There's absolutely no doubt that exec rem is a challenge in this space. And, you know, there is a sense that, you know, that's where the profits go. You know, this is a view in the community that if a company becomes more profitable, then CEOs get paid a lot more money. So I think, you know, exec rem is definitely an issue, I think, in terms of community perceptions. And I think I understand that. I understand that it's hard for people in the community to understand the salary of, you know, a top 50 or top 100, whatever, CEO. Again, though, I've had this conversation with people where I've sat at a board when we've recruited a CEO of a top 10 company, and with a very clear understanding of the sort of person you wanted, And when you you're running a business which is globally competitive, literally, and you are recruiting from overseas, you have to be competitive. And now in Australia, you also have to have an eye to what you think the market will tolerate. And you know, I can tell you that there are names that come through on your long list that you look at, and then you do the back of the envelope calculation of what that's going to cost and what it looks like in Aussie dollars, and then you do the back of the envelope conversation about a calculation of what it's going to cost you to pay out all the handcuffs they've got, and the shares that they've got, and you just can't afford it. And that's the reality. So I don't, you know, again, do I think the sticker shock influences community attitudes? Absolutely. Do I think that boards aren't considering it? Absolutely not. It takes up such an inordinate amount of time at the moment. Far too many hours of my life. But it's, I don't know what the answer to it is, other than what I think what you're starting to see is companies that are pursuing internal succession where pay is then being brought down. But, you know, that's a gradual process.
Okay. Kate, one for you.
Mm-hmm.
How can employees influence leaders who refuse to take a public position on issues that matter to them? And, you know, this could be perhaps a property trust being asked or invited to take a position on same-sex marriage, for example.
And I think that's, it's really an internal, I mean, if we're talking about employees within an organisation, it's about the employees making themselves heard within the organisation. You know, it's interesting. I've seen over the last couple of weeks, I have heard two different CEOs talk about this specific question, not about, you know, what my employees want, but should I be speaking out on these issues? It's exactly what we're talking about. And I have, and two people in the same sector have taken a very different view. So one CEO said very strongly, I will speak out on climate change. It is top focus for us because it matters to our business. It has an impact. But I will not speak out on any other social issue because there is a divergence of views amongst my stakeholders, my employees, my customers, everyone. So I'm just not going to risk it. So it's a very cautious and conservative approach to take. In the same conversation, I've heard another CEO talk about the fact that they take real responsibility for the impact that they have made on the communities that they create. You know, I am talking about the property sector, and, you know, we create built environments. This person was talking about, we create built environments. They can't be unpicked. We as an organisation have a responsibility to think about the social issues, you know, involved there. So, you know, I think employees in this discussion are really one stakeholder. They should absolutely speak up about what matters to them, but it's more complex for an organisation to decide what they do with that. And it doesn't necessarily mean they ignore it. It just may mean that they don't make a big public stand.
Okay, Natasha.
Mm-hmm.
The issue of diversity at the top level didn't seem to be such a flashpoint for the general community in the survey. Was that interesting to you? Are you surprised by that?
No, because I don't think the question's focused around that space. And for me, it's we're looking for diversity throughout the organisation. And as I mentioned, it's for us, when we recruit grads, we end up with about 30% girls. Not because we only want 30% girls, but because that's what's coming through universities for us. So, and I think that the risk with talking about diversity is that you end up talking about how many women you've got and how many this, and if you don't have a culture of connection, I believe connection where people feel like they belong, and courage to actually speak differently, you just end up with six different looking people sitting around the table. So it's partly about having more women because there's more likelihood of a different experience and a different perspective on things. But if people don't speak up with that perspective, there's no value in having different people.
Melinda, ethical supply chains rated very highly, but did not seem to be such a flashpoint on the business side. Is that because, you know, they're just so intimately aware of every dollar that moves through the business and where it comes from? They...
Yeah, it's a good question, and I'm just trying to... I'm pausing for a moment because I'm trying to remember if there was another question that was going to give me a little bit more evidence for what I'm about to say. You know, I think what the community is saying is it's an important relationship. I think the community, you know, when they talk about ethical supply chains, but they also talk specifically about small suppliers, the treatment of small suppliers, that they see this as almost an equity issue of, you know, big business, small supplier that can't look after themselves. And they definitely think it's important. And they definitely think business should be focused on it. And I think it's possibly an area where some businesses have not necessarily been as focused and or perhaps fully understood the importance of it to a broader group of stakeholders. And here I'll give you another sort of proof point, if you like. I think it's really interesting that the Business Council over the last sort of 4 years has actually been, I think it's 3 or 4 years, has been very focused on this. And the Supplier Code of Conduct, I think is what it's called, that they've got members signing up to, which is about terms for payment. So, you know, for years and years and years, we've been hearing small businesses talk about the difficulty that is caused for them by large companies extending the payment periods for them. And so, you know, I think that has become an issue that larger businesses are now more acutely aware of. It's being reflected in this survey. But equally, I think, certainly from the actions of the Business Council, they are demonstrating that they are trying to respond to that in the same way that they are also encouraging businesses to sign up to the Tax Transparency Code. I think a couple of these messages have been, you know, heard by them, you know, prior to this survey coming out, and they're trying to be on the front foot in demonstrating that. And that's where I think, you know, the space is to sort of, you know, that the two areas that are called out here, I think there are other areas that are called out here where there are opportunities now for business to actually respond to that and to be more transparent about, one, that they've heard it, and they can go and test it with their own stakeholders if they like, and two, in demonstrating how they're responding to it.
We have some roving mics, which you may have detected. So if there's any hands from the floor with a question in mind.
Hi, Alexandra Lott from Ace Island Consulting. There's a glaring disconnect I noticed in your data. The community, as a we, seems to want the products and services at the lowest possible price, yet they want them produced at the highest ethical, environmental and social standards. How do we reconcile with that? Can we have our cake and eat it too?
I mean, I think it's a good call out. It's probably one I wasn't entirely surprised about because I'll point you to another data point that's in there, which is that when we ask people, do you think people will make decisions based on the ethical performance of a business? I can't remember the exact numbers, but a certain proportion said yes, and a certain smaller proportion said that they personally make decisions based on the ethical performance. And I think the way I explain those two things is that if they're asked those two issues in isolation, they think it's important, but of course where the rubber hits the road is on how this translates in cost of product. And so what I would say is that they believe that, you know, the performance on these broader indicators matters, and when possibly when they can afford to exercise those decisions they do. But at the moment, you know, the big takeout for me at the moment is that the community is very focused on the incomes they're earning and their capacity to provide for themselves in the way that they need to.
From the front.
One of the data points that really interested me from the survey was around tax. Large corporations weren't paying their fair share of tax. In August of this year, the ATO came out and said small business is a tax black hole in the economy. It's about $12 billion. It's worse than the global average. It was reported by Peter Ryan in the ABC, but I don't think it got a lot of widespread coverage. It certainly didn't feature in any political platforms or stump speeches by the Prime Minister or the Treasurer or the opposition. Apart from the wonderful institution, how many objective voices calling out some of the big issues in the economy can where do we start to see, you know, the awareness building in the community so that some of the challenges in the survey begin to get a bit more balance?
So just on the issue around small business, two observations. Firstly, I do think that the community has, again, my take on the survey is the community has broad and high expectations of big business, and that's not a bad thing. I think there are, the tax issue, as I said, is something that's been around since the mid-70s. It's clearly a source of aggravation. It probably stems, back to the question around exec pay and, that people bundle these things together. I don't want to... When we ask... We were particularly focused on the issue of big business because that's the how so much of this conversation plays out, and because I do think, big businesses, for all the challenges they confront, have to be an important voice in the reform agenda. Our leading, most competitive businesses, small or large, have to be part of that voice. But we did ask a question around, does the community, did respondents have similar expectations of small business? And the answer was yes. But the simple fact of the matter is, one, I think more people are probably closer to a small business and maybe have a sense that they pay more tax or pay their fair share or expect that they do, I don't know. But there's, I just think it's one of those things that there's just not going to be as much natural scrutiny of it.
I think we have a question at the back. We've got time for one more if anyone would like to challenge the panel.
And I should have said AICD, of course, Angus.
On that note, I'll invite Veronica up for our big finish.